Overlooking Phoenix, from high above in the Star Worldwide Network studios, Badge Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another edition of the Badge Boys, the show where two cops talk to the community. I'm retired Crime Stopper Sergeant Darren Birch.
I'm retired Phoenix Police Officer Jason Schechterly.
And we have another riveting episode, continuation of April with Sexual Assault Awareness Month. We have an incredible guest, B.A. Crisp. She is an author, a survivor, and she has an amazing success story that you're going to want to hear. It's really going to be one of the best shows. Then we go into Cop Talk. We're going to talk about Canada. We're going to talk about that horrific tragedy that occurred over the weekend. Then we go into our last segment, heroic headlines, stupid suspect stories galore, and so much more. So stay tuned, stay informed, and most of all, you're going to be entertained.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment. I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back. And like I was talking to the audience, Jason, this is an incredible guest. And after a year of doing shows, the guests just keep getting better.
Yeah.
And again, with Sexual Assault Awareness Month, I don't want to belabor the point. As a sex crimes detective, I really like hearing from these amazing women that have taken something horrific in their past and then doing such amazing things.
Yeah, you're passionate about it. And we sit here every week with our producer, Robin, who has shared her story. And it means something to us, and that's all. That's what matters.
Don't make me cry, guys.
So we have B.A. Crisp on the line. B.A. is an author, a survivor, and an American amazing success story. Having been homeless after a horrible foster care experience and going from forging her own emancipation paperwork to traveling abroad, earning her master's degree of a valedictorian distinction on her way to Oxford. She's traveled to Mexico and South America studying brothels and working with federal agents on anti-human trafficking and crisis intervention efforts. Now, as an author, beautiful book called Redbird, and we'll be talking about that because I just read it, just gave an Amazon review. It's amazing. And as a founder of a D.C.-based research facility, having only talked with the White House officials moments ago about the COVID-19 crisis, literally she got off the phone. She is literally embedded in a law enforcement family because she's married to cops. B.A., welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here, and I thank you for having me. And thank you too, Robin.
Aw, thank you for being here. Another strong woman voice. I love it.
You know, I usually start these interviews, as Jason knows, and Jason does the same thing when he has a guest on. We start kind of like from the beginning, talk about what occurred, and we go chronologically. But yours is such a beautiful success story, having just got off the phone with the White House about COVID-19, having your own research-based facility in the D.C. Network, if you will. Tell us a little bit about what was that like talking to the White House about COVID-19, if you can share, if you can't totally understand, and talk about your life now as an author and research founder. Talk about that.
Okay. Well, I can't say too much about the White House phone call other than to say it was one of your Arizona senators who was also on the call, Senate President Karen Fan, who I think is just amazing. I can't say that. What I can say is it was an honor to be invited to participate in part of that call. And I think that by the end of May, America will have a whole new foundational vista. So, and I'm saying this in a positive respect. So awesome. That's all I can say about that. And then you asked me about the author,
yes.
being an author. So that was when I started the process of writing the book is very loosely based, and a lot of poetic license is very loosely based on my true story. So, it's fiction. I must preface that. But I started it out as a way, I wanted to empower, foster kids because I was a foster kid and it was a 6-year cathartic experience for me. And I had a learning curve. So, I had actually started writing, when I was a kid. And I remember wanting so badly to want to go to college. And I had this lady who was not really a guardian. She was someone that I knew. She was an authority figure. And I remember she stuck a broom in my hand and she said, girls like you do not go to college. They do menial labor because you cannot help to marry well. And, and you have to remember, I'm going to date myself here, but this is going back into the early 80s. So, it was devastating to me to hear that.
And horrible.
And it was a cop and a caseworker who changed the trajectory of my life. Oh. Well, I changed that, but they were the ones who zipped off the labels and said, you could go to college. You're smart. And I'd never heard that before. And when I started writing Redbird, it was a cathartic experience for me. And I realized, wow, there's a lot of emotions that I hadn't yet examined. And the other thing it taught me to do was stand back and grow in circumspection and realize that certain people that I had initially thought, oh, they're black or they're white. And I mean, in terms of their ideology, they're black or white. It wasn't always like that. It was through the book I learned, well, there are gray areas in intelligence, in military, in government, in politics. Things aren't as clear cut or easy as what I call armchair experts want to make it when we're battling back and forth on social media pages.
You know, and reading the book, and like I said, I read it, gave best review I've ever given anybody because it really is that good of a book. It really is. And I mean that. The very first sentence caught me. Handcuffs hurt. As you start to explain this character, Sam, which is loosely based on you, and the way she's at the Trails End Motel, which is a great metaphor for her life in foster care, because that's where it gets the worst of the worst. And I don't want to give too much away about the book, but it's a murder mystery wrapped around a riddle and a science fiction and supernatural. It has so many elements to include a covert lab with the government. There's a lot of neat things in it, but I couldn't help but feel such power and truth and gritty realism when you talk about the foster care situation and how these young girls were being trafficked and sexually exploited. Can you talk a little bit about your foster care experience and about this police officer that helped you out of that world and how it does parallel or doesn't parallel with your character?
Yes. So when I was in foster care, I went into foster care when I was about 6 years old. And I was there for a few years. And then I actually went into a group home as a juvenile. So when I was about 16 years old until I aged out of the foster care system. And one of the things about foster care is at the time, and I understand it's changed considerably, but at the time, you weren't really taught life skills. So the day you turned 18, you were pretty much cut loose from the system. So in my situation, I was a runaway, and I would, I was living on the street. I had a job though, so I was actually working as a waitress at a truck stop. Liberal education there, but I the one thing that I loved to do was read, and I read all the time, and I do believe that was my saving grace. So I discovered through my reading at the time, and remember, we're going back before the internet or smartphones or any of that. So I discovered legal emancipation. So I basically illegally, legally emancipated myself from my parents who really, they really, unfortunately, and they're both gone now, but they cared more about partying than parenting. And it's a sad thing to say, but it's true. And my mother was institutionalized. So, anyway, I in the foster care system, when I legally emancipated myself, I got caught. And that was because another authority figure had reported me missing, and it was a cop who found me. And I was on the streets in Ohio, and he basically figured out that I was this missing kid, and he took me in. And boy, did I go kicking and screaming. I was not happy. And because, you know, the one thing after a teenager, after especially an older teenager, once she's had her freedom, she does not like to have this taken away. So, kicking and screaming, I was placed into a juvenile group home, and I was ordered into multiple psychiatric evaluations because at the time they didn't know as much about paranoid schizophrenia as they do today. And for whatever reason, they tended to sort of think, that it was so maybe inherited and I would probably get it. And I remember people talking that way in front of me, and I would do these psychological evaluations. And then I finally went to the judge, and when I got before the judge, he couldn't believe it because the psychologist who'd given me the evaluations came in. He not only wrote a letter of recommendation to the court that I be emancipated, he actually came and spoke. And my caseworker, wow, his name was Bill Catalano, and I'll never forget him. Wow. And Mark Smith was actually the deputy out of Erie County who found me. And I don't know whatever happened to Mark. It'd be great to find him again and thank him. But both were the two gentlemen who basically said, you know, you can go on from this. So.
And speaking of going on, you end up traveling to Mexico, South America, helping in the, I don't want to say human trafficking if I'm wrong, but setting brothels and helping with crisis intervention. Can you talk a little bit about that world? How you transitioned from, you know, runaway, emancipated illegally to this?
Yeah, well, it wasn't an overnight success story, believe me. So, I mean, go ahead and put this out there. So when I was cut loose from the system, if you will, I took a job and became a victim of minimum wage. And I worked at a mall pet store. And I already now by this point, and we're moving ahead, but I did graduate from high school. I had a baby, and you guys don't need to know how that happens, right?
No, we have a book that tells us. We have a book that tells us.
But I had a baby, and I'm trying to support my son, and it's very difficult to do on minimum wage as a single mom. And I really, that dream of going to college stuck with me. So eventually I did. I ended up going to college. I ended up having more kids. But when I went to college, I thought what a great research project it would be. And I actually graduated summa cum laude from Ursuline College, which was a Catholic, it's a female, it was an all-women's college at the time in Pepper Pike, Ohio. So when I left there, I thought, well, I'll do some research on brothel tours. So I started touring in Panama because it's legal. Costa Rica and Panama, prostitution is legal there. And my first question was, what drives women to do this? And you have to remember there's like five forms of trafficking. There's labor trafficking, domestic trafficking, agricultural trafficking. There's child warriors, which we really don't have in this country. And then there's the sex trafficking, which everyone tends to primarily focus upon because sure, it seems most titillating. So I started asking these ladies, why do you do this? And then I noticed something in Costa Rica that really caught my eye. And there were some very young looking people in some of these brothels, some very young looking young ladies. And they didn't speak English, but they didn't speak Spanish either. They were Russian.
Wow.
And that was very surprising to me. So that piqued my interest into another area. And one of the things I did to support myself, and I'm backing up now, is I did go into the strip club industry, and I became a dancer. After I was working in the pet store and I couldn't make ends meet, out of socioeconomic desperation, I danced. Now, a lot of people say, oh my gosh, that's a tombstone to nowhere. For me, it was a stepping stone. And would I advise anybody to everybody, every woman to do that? Hell no. No, I wouldn't. But I will say that I did meet a lot of very interesting people, and it's not just six guys in raincoats supporting that industry. So I met bankers, and, you know, and I had this, you know, banker show me, he said, pick my brain, it's free. And he said, you know, if you can put away $300 a week on a conservative 10% return on your investment by the time you're 36, you can retire with $2 million in the bank and live on $260,000 a year, never touch a principal. So I'm like, that sounds like a deal for me. So I did go to school. I did. And then when I was in graduate school at George Washington University, I thought, I want to help build this program. So it was another cop who helped me. He partnered with me, and his name was Mike Acello, and he partnered with me to create Coast. And we started doing club operators against sex trafficking, and we went to federal agents. And it was Homeland Security investigations who really took the reins on this. Now we work with everybody. We've worked with the FBI. We've worked with Homeland Security. We've worked with state police. We actually work with state police in Arizona, I believe, a couple of times, and HSI agents there, and their victims assistance specialists. So my whole thing was, I started looking at the strip club industry and saying, how can we make a difference here? Because I was hearing from elected officials and law enforcement, oh, it's a problem, it's a big problem, it's a big problem. And I thought, well, do we know what human trafficking is? And the answer was no, we don't know what it is exactly. And once we learned that, it's like what we were really seeing is this is, at least within that industry, it's a crime of ignorance. So we started doing these programs, and law enforcement officials always lead the trainings because I think that gives it much more credibility.
Sure.
And they teach people in the industry the indicators and how to report, because you can say, if you see something, say something, but what does that mean when it really comes down to doing it? And think about that. And so we tell people, if you don't be a vigilante, let the police do their job. It's up to them. You just give them as much information as possible without putting yourself or that potential victim or suspected victim in harm's way.
If I'm understanding you correctly, the Coast program, you would help educate the club owners or people that were in the, I hate to use the word sex industry, but the entertainment, adult entertainment industry, about potential human trafficking. Am I right on that, or am I way off?
You are, but it wasn't just the owners. So it's dancers, it's everybody. We've trained code enforcement people. We've even worked with undercovers. So I was in New Mexico when we did that. But so what we do is we just try to train all people in the industry, because I think it's important, because young people who are going in and out of clubs, nail salons, hair salons, they could be the extension of eyes and ears to law enforcement. And we also have to couch it around, because they're always taught cops are bad, cops are bad. And I always make the joke that cops and strippers have a lot in common because they're so misunderstood.
That's the best line of the year.
It is. And a lot of cops know we all know the topless dance places in our beat. So
they make great CIs, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, if you can educate people that this is a heinous crime, and I always ask people in the industry, how many of you have kids? How many of you have a brother, a sister, a mom, a dad, an aunt? Somebody always has somebody. And I said, if they were in danger like this, would you want someone to help them? And every hand goes up. So that's the thing. It's not about being a rat, a snitch, a narc, or anything like that. It's really about saving a lifeline. Yeah.
And
they could be the only link.
I love how you talked about these Russian immigrants. That's a bad word. These Russian plants, for lack of a better phrase, that are embedded into another country. They don't have the resources, the ability, the networking to get out of this. So somebody in the industry seeing this can become that lifeline. That's
right.
Amazing.
And we've had many tips. And what happens now usually is people carry my card, and they'll be like, and we had a dad call me at 3:20 in the morning out of Houston, and without giving too much away, and it was a waitress at a club who had given him my card. The girl, his daughter wasn't there. She wasn't working in any clubs, but I do credit law enforcement because, and it was federal law enforcement. I credit them. They found her, and it was based on the father's information. And the waitress had given him the card and said, call this lady. She knows how to help. And he did. Of course, my husband had to get me through. My husband's like, why is the guy calling you at 3:20 in the morning?
I'm glad you mentioned your husband, because I want to transition a little bit to, in the closing minutes that we have left, I want to talk a little bit about your beautiful family. Again, it goes back to the success story that you have now. You are in a law enforcement family, literally. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, okay. First of all, when I became part of this family, I was told three things. I would never be right, I would never get my way, and I would never get away with a thing.
Wow.
And this is not just from your husband, but his family.
No. So my father-in-law is a retired Secret Service agent, and he worked with President Clinton. He worked with President Ford. He guarded Susan Ford, and he also worked with Reagan, I believe, too. So one hell of a guy. And just really have a lot of respect for him. And I've met some of the people that he's worked with. And then my mother-in-law worked for the DOD and the FBI. So that was pretty interesting. And my husband, so he's had a little change. So he was a certified law enforcement officer and just recently retired.
Oh, good for
him. Like 2 weeks ago.
So, congratulations to him and them, your family. And I got to ask you about the book. What I love about it so much was the gritty realism in the beginning when you talk about the foster system, because as a cop, I've come across what they used to call incorrigible juveniles. And I hated that phrase because every juvenile is incorrigible. Yeah, every kid is incorrigible if they can. I've gone some bad situations, and the way these kids just absolutely hug you, and you really are that lifeline for them. And they came and put in words how they just want to grab you and hold you, that's one of the most rewarding things about police work is when you come across a child and able to help them out of a bad situation. And the beginning of your book really goes into that. And then, of course, it goes into the kind of science fiction, supernatural, murder mystery. It goes everywhere. Tell us about the book and a strong, inspiration to write it.
Okay. So Redbird had been on my mind for years. And the inspiration to write it, it had always been there. So I'd been taking notes, I'd been doing research, and I originally was going to make it sort of a CIA spy type of book. And characters really do take over. And that was one thing I learned when I was in my writing classes at Oxford, that the characters do take over. And you need that great first line, too, and hence handcuffs hurt so to my head. So this is not a kid's book.
No.
So it's not young adult fiction. This is not a book for kids to read. And one of the things, there was a scene in there, and I don't want to give too much of the book away.
Sure.
There was a scene in there that is not appropriate for kids at all. And, but I did, you know, there was some debate, take it out. And
I know what you're talking about.
Yes. Yeah. And no, you have to leave it in. And I opted to leave it in because
it's germane.
Rawness.
Yeah, it's germane.
It is. Yeah, it is. So, I didn't want to sugarcoat anything because crime, the crime of sex trafficking, the crimes of rape, the sexual assault crimes, they're a horrible thing for a woman to go through. And I always ask guys, what if it happened to you? And guys, that would never happen to me. What if it did?
Yeah.
Think of the pain.
Can't wrap our heads around it.
Your head around it.
No.
So, you know, it was, like I said, the catharsis. So it was a process. And there were times where I was evasive, guarded, soapboxy. And those were the things I had to learn to unleash. Let that go. And it's my story, but it's not my story. And I had initially started thinking about it in terms of a in terms of a memoir. And I said, no, I'm not there yet. I'm just not quite there yet. So so this was kind of the process with Redbird, and I gave it to beta readers. And David Gatewood, I don't know if you guys know of an author named Hugh Howey, but he's a very successful science fiction writer. And it was David Gatewood who edited Redbird. And Hugh Howey is now under contract, I believe, for a series called, it was Silo and Wool series. And I guess it went on to Amazon or Netflix or some film. So he was the editor. And, you know, he took a chance, and he edited the book. And so far it's been doing really well, and the reviews have been pretty awesome.
Oh,
so
it's truly, you know, and having written a little book myself, it really does take a village, doesn't it?
Yes, and I read your book too, by the way, and it was very compelling. And I too gave you a review, and I, you know, I thought you did a damn good job with that. And I laughed and I cried, and there were great stories.
The hardest part was getting the crayon markings out. That was the hardest part of the editing process. In close, for anyone listening, now that they get their pens and papers and so forth, if you would tell us how they can get this book, and there's a reference in it in memory of Sergeant Linda Pierre.
Sergeant Linda Pierre. So she was a friend of mine. I was the last person to see her stateside before she went off to Afghanistan. She was a sergeant in the Army. And unfortunately, on April 16th, 2011, she was part of a team. And there was a Taliban member posing as a soldier, and he pulled a grenade, and she lost her life along with four of her unit members. And she was at a remote outpost. That was devastating for me, because I woke up on a Saturday morning, I sat up, and I got the push, the news push, and it said five NATO members killed. And I looked, my husband said, what's the matter? And I said, Linda's gone. And he's like, you don't know that, honey. There's a lot of people. I go, Linda's gone. And he went to his dad. His dad got the information. And his dad, and he came in, he said, I still get emotional. He said, I'm sorry. I live every single day of my life trying to honor hers. And, you know, I don't want to waste any potential. She wouldn't have wanted that.
Well,
so
you
every,
did,
yeah.
You
that
did
was
her,
beautifully
you,
said,
you
too.
You did her memory something with this book. It's a beautiful book. I'm glad you had that relationship with her. May she rest in peace, that hero. We cannot thank you enough for your time with us and sharing such just stories. And I can't wait to get to know you more and get the next book.
Which is almost done, by the way. But I think we're going to throw it out to our readers on what the title will be and what cover they like. So I think we're going to kind of go that direction. We're going to give them three titles and three covers and let our readers know.
I can't wait to put my 2 cents in. Again, you can find this anywhere on Amazon. It's called Redbird by B.A. Crisp. Again, B.A., thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Jason, Darren, Robin, you guys have been great, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
And we'll be right back with Cop Talk.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
I'll never forget.
Never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
My first call up ever as a member of the National Guard.
When we got to the armory, they briefed us on the wildfires. They were getting dangerously close to homes.
Helicopters were going out to drop water on the fires.
Guys in the unit were preparing for firefighting with local fire crews.
At that moment, I got my first taste of just how important the Guard is to my community.
See how the Guard can be an important part of your life at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Batch Boys with retired Police Sergeant Darren Birch and retired Police Officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Batch Boys.
Wow, that was a riveting whirlwind of information. What a life well lived regarding our last guest, B.A. Crisp.
Amazing.
It really is. There's no words that can truly describe what you just heard. Again, definitely get the book, Red Bird by B.A. Crisp, available on Amazon and anywhere. It's a great read. I just an hour ago left a review on Amazon for it because five stars. Great book. Awkward segue into something that happened, over the weekend. A horrible event. I hate to use, tragic and horrible because it just pales to describe the carnage.
Yeah, and those words are starting to get old. Overused and old.
I agree. But there's no words to truly encapsulate the pain, the suffering, the carnage of this one, I'm just going to say it, monster. And for those who don't know what we're talking about Canada. At least 23, including a police officer, were killed in Nova Scotia over the weekend. I have a real quick article. At first counting on, Sunday, they had 16 dead. Then on Monday, they had 19. And then on Tuesday, it's 23. And they knew the death count would keep climbing. And here's why. Again, including a police officer or dead following a 12-hour shooting rampage. And now that 12-hour has become more like 13-hour. They've discovered because he did some shooting and killing that was targeted before he went on this random killing spree in Nova Scotia, according to Canadian authorities. The suspected shooter is also dead. Thank heavens. It's thought to be Canada's... Sorry, I had to throw it in there.
Of course. No, please do. Yeah. Thank God.
It's thought to be Canada's deadliest mass shooting in recent history. It is, by the way.
I was going to say, it's thought to be. Either it is or it isn't.
That was the initial article, because it was so horrible. There's that word again. That they even the reporters had a hard time wrapping their heads around, trying to think when the last shooting was, which was 3 decades earlier, which was the worst shooting killing spree. At that time, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, identified the alleged gunman. I hate the word alleged. He's the gunman, Gabriel Wortman, 51. They believe he acted alone, leading police on a chase through a northern part of Canada, Providence, and began Saturday and came to an end Sunday morning. They identified the deceased officer as, bless her heart, Constable Heidi Stevenson, who had been with the force for 23 years.
Jeez.
Another officer was also shot and injured, and we'll talk about him a little bit. Quote, the impact of this incident will extend from one end of this province to the other, said Lee Bergman, Assistant Commissioner of the Nova Scotia Mounted Police. As Nova Scotians, we have to do what we are known for and come together in times of need and support one another. The shooting began Saturday night in the small rural community of Portapique, where police responded to reports of gunfire. The chase ended around 11:40 a.m. local time on Sunday outside of a gas station in this small rural community of Enfield. The article goes on and on, and I'll read a little bit more as we talk, but I couldn't help but think, we don't think of Canada as, oh my gosh, the underbelly of these type of crimes. We don't think of it like we do with South America or with the cartel in Mexico. It's Canadians, eh?
What we do think of Canada is it's the kindest place in the world. And I'll tell you, when it comes to Nova Scotia, I'm probably being conservative, but for at least the last 10 years, I've always thought that is one place I want to go visit.
Yes.
And one of my favorite things about dreaming, fantasize about going there is knowing how safe I'll be, unless I do something stupid on a boat or out in the water. Nova Scotia is, you can't even contemplate that something like this would happen. And I know we say that all the time. It shouldn't have happened in tons of places that it does. But this really hit home with me. Like, if there's a monster up there, then, there are monsters
everywhere.
Everywhere. So, Darren, I want to get your perspective on something because I think we agree but mildly disagree. It's being called a mass shooting.
It is.
And it's a mass shooting because a lot of people died.
It is.
However, he did not walk into one place. He did not open fire and kill a lot of people. And when I think of mass shootings, I think of course, Columbine.
Las Vegas.
The Pulse nightclub. I think of the Las Vegas concert. That's a mass shooting. One guy standing in one place, going crazy with a gun and killing a lot of people. This jerk off drove, I don't know how many miles, over almost an entire day killing random. I'm sure his initial, once he got started, it was a domino effect for him. Like, how long can I keep going before I get caught? So to me, this is not so much a mass shooting as it is a serial killer. He just did not do the Ted Bundy thing and spread it out over 30 years. He did it all in one day. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on how, because again, we live in a world where you and I can sit on air, off air, and we can have a decent conversation about this. We can have an intelligent conversation about this. But when you listen to the news and when you listen to politicians, that all goes out the window. So I'm just wondering what your thought. I don't consider this a mass shooting. And I'm not saying I'm right or wrong. Just when I think about it, he's a serial killer. The result is the same. Same amount of people are dead.
It's about a label.
The same tactics are the same. But this is a unique. I don't recall hearing about something where the guy was able, and he used a police vehicle. That helped for him to, and I don't know how many miles, maybe you have it on your paper over there, how far he actually traveled over 13 hours. But he's a serial killer in my case. But our listeners are going to argue, well, the guy who walked into the Pulse nightclub and shot up 50 people, he's a serial killer too. Right. But a mass to me is a group, a gathering where you infiltrate it with a dedication to causing as much carnage and destruction as you can. He did that as well, but he did not do it in one place. So it's just an interesting take that I have on how they're labeling him versus, because to be a serial killer, anytime you kill three people or more, you're a serial killer. And he did this in different locations at different times. I know it wasn't 30 years, it wasn't the Green River Killer, it wasn't Ted Bundy, but to me, he's still a serial killer.
When I was in the homicide unit with the night detectives, at the end of the day, I had to take the totals of what occurred, the carnage of that night, and put it in numbers. And I'd had to decide, because it's all based on the FBI tallying these numbers. That's who, for America, sets the standards on what a mass shooter is opposed to a serial killer. And a mass killer is one who, it's one incident. Now, not one location, but it's one incident in which there was no rest. And I always joke about, he didn't go to sleep and have cereal the next morning. That's my stupid, right. Stupid hint to myself what the difference is. Right. So as far as if this was going to be categorized with the FBI, which it's not, it's a different country. So it's really, I don't want to use the word semantics, but it's about, like you said, it's a label. And so your label is just as good as anyone else's label. If this had occurred in America, it would be a mass shooting only because there was no end, significant end to his carnage. In other words, he was driving nonstop,
just continuous.
Continuously going from one scene to the next. Had he stopped at a hotel, spent the night, and a good, if you want to make a comparison, remember the monster who shot up the Big Bear Country, I think it's called, California, and he was shooting, aiming for cops. You remember that?
Yeah.
And so there was a stoppage because he went to sleep. There was like a 12-hour days went by where there's nothing that occurred. Then he kept shooting. It wasn't because his intent was over. He still wanted to kill people indiscriminately, randomly, and targeting as well, which kind of brings this case into play too, because in this particular horrific incident in Nova Scotia, he first killed family members and then went on a ride along from hell in a mock police car that looked just like a police car. So there's, it shows a little bit of intent.
How did he get that?
Their police cars look a little bit different in terms of it was just had the right logos, and how he got away with it, we're going to find out. You know, and that's why I like when they said, right now, he's the only one involved as far as they know. Who helped him with this? Who helped him with that the detailing of that police car, and I'm using air quotes, who helped them with that?
It's not that hard to do. My son builds movie cars, and they get decals made from people, so it's not that hard to do.
No, and it's not the difficulty of it. It's the someone should have said something.
Right.
Somebody should have said, hey, you may want to look at this Yahoo who is creating a fake police car. For what purpose? There's, you know, is he part of the movie industry? No. Is he part of, you know, a vehicle club restoring vintage police cars? No. Is he going to do something bad with this? Yes. Those sort of things. But back to your original question regarding how do we label this guy, you know, mass killer in terms of one event spanning 16 separate that we know of. There's probably a lot more even this morning.
Yeah, that we know of right now.
Over a continuous 13-hour time period, opposed to that guy in California, Big Bear Country, where he ended up shooting more people, I think, over a long period of time, but there was those downtime. There was an actual downtime. So, that's my assessment. That's kind of what I go, only because that's how I was trained, you know, only. But to your point, you know, he's a serial killer in a sense that he went and randomly was shooting people for no, they were not targeted for any other reason than they were at the wrong place at the wrong time after his initial killing of family members.
Yeah, and this brings up another point that how often do we hear about this? This happens.
Too often.
You can't say all the time because it's not every day, but it happens.
Too often.
Way too often. And the immediate thing you hear is, of course, the politicians and Justin Trudeau, his biggest thing was a call for ban on assault weapons. And look, I am an old school Arizona conservative. I believe in the Second Amendment. I was a military guy. I was a cop. But I will also be the first one to tell you that outside of SWAT teams and outside of the military, I agree. Nobody should own assault weapons. It's just not something I would do. I would not own an AR-15. I would not go hunting with it. I would not shoot for fun with it. That's more of a personal. I'm not putting that on anybody else out there. It's more of a personal thing. But when I hear a politician like Justin Trudeau say that, all I can think of is, yeah, that's all great and wonderful that that's what you are required to say or what you believe. But I'd love to know how many red flags were in this guy's past prior to the morning of that shooting, because I guarantee you he did not lead a solid, upstanding life all the way up to that day. There's no way that everybody is going to say he was a perfect, and I don't know a lot about his background, husband, father, friend, business partner, employee. There were red flags, and this is every time one of these happens. Every time you can go back and look and realize, you know, we could have stopped this. But because we live in the world of political correctness now.
And freedom.
It is 100%. Let's just talk about it after it's over. Let's lock the gate after the horse has already left. And that just continues to drive me crazy. Because all this means, Darren, 100% all this means is next week or next month, we're going to be sitting here talking about another mass shooting or serial killer. And the only thing that gets done about it is rhetoric from different viewpoints and different sides as compared to what can we actually do to prevent these and notice the red flags that are leading up to it.
You know, the thing I look at, I don't mind having a conversation, but it's got to be a constructive conversation. It can't be a conversation for the purpose of spewing your agenda, whatever that agenda is. This should not be used as fodder to you to propel as a politician your agenda, whatever that may be.
But that's all it's used for.
And that's the sad part, because when you talk about what they have in common, there is no commonality. Look at Las Vegas. This was someone that had a clean fingerprint in terms of his background. He had no criminal record. There was nothing. And we've had time to look and really dissect it. We're not at that point, obviously, with the Canadian tragedy.
Right.
But we had time to look at that Las Vegas shooter. And please, if someone knows more information, please, you know, weigh in. We'll correct it.
Love
correct it. But for what I know, there was nothing that somebody could have said, okay, without a doubt, he's going to do this now. Other than there was some talk about the girlfriend, I'm using air quotes, where she may have known more. But this is something he...
Not may have known more. She knew more.
And so other than that one person, but us as a society, and that's what I look at, like when you... And your point is well taken in terms of there's clearly on most of these shootings and tragedies, there is some type of red flag that went overlooked and maybe politically we were forced to overlook. In other words, our hands were tied as law enforcement, that sort of thing. But the one thing that is common, the commonality, and it's the only thing I've found in every single one of these things, is hatred. They are consumed by hatred. And unfortunately, we as Americans have, unfortunately, as well as fortunately, we have these great freedoms, and we have the right to be hateful. It's a shame, and social media has, I think, increased that exponentially, because now we have no filters to calm ourselves down. We have no filters when we talk to someone. We have our best friend and say, calm down.
You could be anonymous.
And you have the power of anonymity. You're right.
Yeah, I didn't grow up like that. That's probably the one thing that really
huge. It's huge. Really the mob mentality
hurts me the most is the anonymity.
And that's the mob mentality. With a mob, you have anonymity. You can become ugly as much as you want because there is that anonymity. And like you said, I'm going to continue this in the next article. Canadian police were yet to determine a motive for the country's worst mass shooting as a death toll from the 13-hour carnage. Again, they increased the death toll, climbed to 23 from 19. It's expected the number of victims to increase as it investigates the 16 crime scenes at that point. This was yesterday in the Atlantic province of Nova Scotia that were part of the spree of murders, several of which included burnt out homes. Bizarre. This guy attacked everything. He burnt things down. The gunman, again, 51-year-old, I'll just call him Monster. I'm not going to give him any credit for his name. We can also call him POS. At one point, masqueraded as the Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer and disguised his car to look like a police cruiser, and it looked like a police cruiser. Again, he shattered the peace of this rural community during a rampage that started late on Saturday afternoon. He was shot by police at noon on Sunday. Police did not say if he was counted among the 23 dead. I haven't seen the latest versions. The youngest among those who was killed was 17 years old. Again, also a veteran police officer and a teacher and a nurse. We're talking good people are taken from our community because of this monster. The investigative team is focused on learning more about the very tragic situation, including the accurate victim information where others may have aided in the suspect. Was there people involved who might have known about this to Jason's point? The Nova Scotia Premier Stephen McNeil told a news conference on Tuesday that Canada's Attorney General told him the military would be assisting in this investigation. And it just kills me. But I tell you what, it does, talking about the worst, you know, to their memory, in Canada, which has a tighter gun ownership restrictions, which Jason brought up, than the U.S., mass shootings were relatively uncommon. Before this weekend, the nation's, and when we're talking Canada, that nation's worst mass shooting happened in 1989, 3 decades earlier, when a gunman in Quebec killed 14 women after opening fire at a college 30 years ago. What's interesting to me is this is horrible. It probably will double that count from 30 years ago, from 14 to 20 plus high numbers probably. Right now, again, it's 23, but I could see it going up to 28, sadly. As we're looking at transients and different people that he may have killed that are still lying in the brush across all of Nova Scotia or the eastern portion of it. But it reminds me that just 9 months earlier, we had two Canadian teens that went on a serial killing spree. Because there was night went into day went to night. There was one period of a 24-hour period where they didn't find anyone murdered, and they traveled across the greater part of Canada, killing indiscriminately, randomly, with no real target in mind. And then they end up killing themselves, so we don't even have the benefit of answers to why.
No, we have no idea why they did what they did.
And again, I hate to say this, thank you. We have hatred. But I think that's all we had with these two Yahoos. We didn't have like a, you know, again, they're teens, so they could have done things that they weren't accounted for or we don't know about because I think Canada does do what we do in terms of the juvenile holding back their records or criminal records. So when they're adult, they're pretty much sealed until you have a reason to unseal them. But why? Why in this 1 year period are we seeing this? And for those who are talking about gun control, again, I don't mind the conversation. And unlike you, Jason.
No, I don't mind it at all.
I have an AR-15. Now, why did I buy mine? Well, I went to a event that was a fundraiser event that I think the 100 Club was putting on, in fact. And I went ahead and bought it. I have not fired it. I'll be honest with you. It's sitting in my gun safe, but it's a beautiful weapon.
Yeah.
And I was in the military like you. I love the M16. I love the weapon. And the AR-15, you might as well call it M16, you know, civilian-fied. So I don't even have a problem with the conversation of those who are saying they want to take that away from me. You're going to have to give me a good argument because we have people that are killing with knives and all sorts of weapons of lethality that can kill. And these lethal weapons don't have to be an AR-15. Granted, AR-15 will do the job a lot quicker.
That's my problem, is it will do.
That's a solid point.
I don't know about you as a retired police officer. I still carry my gun. Mainly because I live in a big city with a lot of crime and there are issues, and I do believe in protecting myself, or I'm one to go into, you look at all of these mass shootings or what's going on, and they are so random that you cannot say when or where it's going to happen. So I am very vigilant of, and I have no problem with, I'll give you an example. A couple months ago, I was going to the gym, and I am a member of Planet Fitness. I will give them a shout out. I love them because they're open 12 or 24 hours a day. Not right now.
No.
But so I'm one that, you know, sometimes I have insomnia, so I'll go at midnight. I'll go at 10 a.m. It's random. Well, I got out of my car one day and walking in front of my car, screaming into a phone, was a gentleman who had his shirt off, tucked into the back of his pants, and just probably from my former career, a couple red flags, like, what's this? And he was screaming. And then he was screaming some pretty bad stuff, like, you have no idea the demons that I'm fighting. You have no idea the people I want to hurt.
Schizophrenia.
And I'm standing there. All I'm doing is trying to get from my car into the gym. But all that crossed my mind was, I am ready to engage with this guy because in a split second, he can turn.
We've seen it.
On a dime.
We've seen it.
And not everybody out there is ready to engage with other people. Not everybody wants to be confrontational. And it's not something that I thrive on. I'm not a confrontational person. I haven't been in a fight since I was a patrol officer 20 years ago. So
that's a defense mechanism.
It is. But but my constant thought comes from my training.
Cop mode.
Is, I am going home today, and if it means you're not,
so be it.
Sorry, but I watch for those red flags, and I still am conscious of protection of self, protection of others, whereas other people are DTO, DTS, danger to others, danger to themselves, and that's where the vigilant needs to come, because saying my thoughts and prayers are with Canada right now, of course it is. Does it do any good? Does it bring back lives? Does it help ease the funerals that are going on right now? No. Does it help pass legislation? No. So we all say thoughts and prayers because that's what we're supposed to say, even though they are heartfelt. I mean, I am thinking about these people right now, and my heart goes out to them, but I can't do anything about them. What I can do is take that as a reminder that it can happen anywhere, anytime, and you have to be vigilant and ready.
Prepared
to protect yourself and protect other people, because this is just the black and white facts are, it's going to continue to happen.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with your point in terms of we have that training in terms of our police law enforcement experience and military. We've both been in the military. And so I too carry a gun. I won't go anywhere
You don't carry your AR-15.
Thank you. No, but I have my duty
weapon. You have it.
Yeah.
You carry your duty weapon.
And we've seen, you know, the, oh my gosh, when the theater in Colorado. Thank you. Colorado Springs, I believe it was.
Aurora.
So, Aurora. We see that it can happen anywhere. It can happen in Nova Scotia. It can happen in Big Bear. It can happen in Mayberry RF frickin' D. It can happen anywhere. So when people talk about, you know, gun debate, I think we need to talk about a hate debate. We need to talk about...
I agree. Mental illness debate.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We need to do something, and that conversation is so critical. But it has got to be constructive. It can't be just to further your agenda because you hate guns in people's hands. Because I'm telling you, we've seen horrible tragedies that we never will know about because somebody stopped it. We have the guy who was across the street from the church, who was the NRA instructor. We don't do a lot of talking about that hero, but he stopped a tragedy from going worse.
That was awesome.
That guy's one of the most ultimate badasses.
Love him.
Of the world. He ran out of his house barefoot and chased the dude. It was the greatest.
I got chills.
The guy is, and if you've ever seen him, he looks like Santa Claus.
Nice.
He looks like Santa Claus.
Yes.
And I'm like, somebody ran into his house, said, hey, they're shooting up the church. And this dude, all he did was grab his gun and took off. And Santa Claus
kicked ass.
He is. I wish we would talk more about guys like that and less about the names of the monsters.
Exactly. And I'm glad we're ending this segment on that note because we're talking about good people with guns can save lives. And that's not a bad thing.
Outstanding.
All right. We'll be back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment. I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to Badge Boys, everybody. And it is time for this week's heroic headline. And unfortunately, this heroic headline has a tragic end, but I want to bring attention to this individual and what's happened. I remember when I was brand new in the academy, the first class that we took was about the lifespan of law enforcement.
You're right.
And most law enforcement officers tend to live about 59 and a half years. And I remember as a young man in my 20s being like, wow, really?
That's old.
That's,
yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, that's old.
I'm 21 year old.
Well, at my age now, it's not old.
Oh, I'm there.
I'm there. But I'm starting to see it. I'm starting to see a lot of guys who retired and they were excited about retirement and then boom, they get cancer.
Yeah.
You know, adrenaline attacks the weakest organs in your body and you don't know what those are. So I know guys who are getting brain cancer, pancreatic cancer, and they're dying within a couple of years.
Just lost a squad mate.
Yeah, and you know what? It is around that age. But here is a gentleman from Weston, Florida, an officer from the Seminole Police Department in Florida, passed away from COVID-19 on April 17th, less than 2 months after he finally retired from the force. After spending roughly over 3 weeks battling the virus in the hospital, the veteran unfortunately succumbed to the illness at the age of 76 years old.
Wow.
Spent nearly three decades, 30 years with the Seminole Police Department. This guy was entitled. And yes, I'm going to say that word, entitled to a nice,
thank you,
healthy retirement.
Yeah.
Officer Calvin Cal Harrison retired from the department on February 25th of this year. But on March 27th, he was admitted to the Cleveland Clinic due to symptoms associated with the pandemic that we are currently going through. Subsequent testing showed that COVID-19 was present in the veteran officer. The executive director for public safety for Seminole Tribe of Florida noted the following after hearing about Harrison's passing. Cal spent 30 years with the Seminole Tribe and was well known in the community and law enforcement circles. He was always a survivor. Sadly, he could not survive the coronavirus. The unbelievable thing about Harrison is he survived being shot in the head in the line of duty many years ago.
Wow.
He survived that. He returned to work. He finished his career. And again, talk about being entitled. So this pandemic that we are facing right now is touching all of us in some way, whether it's loss of job, loss of finances. There has been a lot of loss of life. And yes, Cal was probably one of those. Obviously, he had some underlying conditions. He had been shot in the head. He was 76 years old. But when I read that, I was just heartbroken, thinking, God, less than 2 months after retiring, and you die of this frickin' disease that started in China and is spreading across the world, and you were quietly living your life in Florida, having survived a gunshot wound to the head. So the heroic headline is more about a life well-lived and a death undeserved.
Oh, and you nailed it when you said he was entitled. Absolutely 100%, my friend, to that retirement. Bless his heart. I have to go now from something so heroic in terms of a life well-lived.
Did you notice my heroic headline, by the way, Robin?
Beautiful.
Yes, but I want to point out that it came from Florida because I want to elevate all the people. Darren has completely gotten Florida to hate us over the past year. So I want to point out
he's
that
redeemed
I up,
Florida.
Good does happen in Florida.
I'm trying to redeem Florida. And so I hope today's disgusting.
Well, you can redeem Florida. I was born there, even though I was raised in Arizona.
Yeah, baby.
So there
born
you
there.
Go.
But yes. I have a feeling Darren's about to bring up some stupid suspect from Florida.
Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of things going on because of COVID-19. There's a lot of people, you know, just acting badly, bad characters, hoarding toilet paper, walking past the soap aisle and stealing toilet paper, and just some stupid cheating type things. So I saw this story and it touched me. Two anglers busted for cheating in a bass tournament. Two fishermen in Utah, so it's not Florida, two fishermen in Utah faced criminal charges for cheating in a bass tournament by catching fish from a different lake and then using them as a weigh-in, as a scheme to bring them in. So they caught these bass from a different lake. Robert Dennett, 45, and Cameron Wooten, 35, both from Washington City, caught bass from Quail Creek Reservoir near St. George, Utah, and transported them to use at a tournament at Lake Powell. The tournament prize was $2,500 for the team with the heaviest five fish caught during the two-day event. The suspects were in second place after their first day and led for overall biggest fish. But tournament officials disqualified them because of the suspicious nature of the fish. That's right, something smelled fishy. Some of the largemouth bass they turned in had little heads and fatter bodies. Yeah, we had a small head, little bass fish, indicating a different diet than the fish at Lake Powell. There's some scientific stuff there. The fish also had red fins, which indicated they had undergone some stress. In other words, they hadn't just been killed. The conservation officers were alerted and subsequently had the fish tested at the University of Utah's lab, along with the fish caught from Lake Powell. And the results determined that the suspicious bass came from Quail Creek. That's forensics. I love this. Quote, illegally moving and introducing fish into different water bodies can cause a lot of damage to the fishery, Washburn said. In this case, there were already largemouth bass at Lake Powell, but you can still run the risk of introducing diseases, blah, blah. Long story short, these guys faked it. I looked at other cases. Two yahoos, also from Utah, they took a shark and cut off the fin and try to pass it as a large fish as well. I found a case in which a fisherman in Texas, he's been indicted by a grand jury in Wood County after allegedly trimming a bass's tail to meet the weigh-in requirements in September's McDonald's Big Bass Splash at Lake Fork. The Terry Keith Long of Bridgeport allegedly altered the animal, the fish, to meet the fishing regulations at the lake east of Dallas, which allows fishermen to keep only largemouth bass 16 inches and smaller, or those 24 inches or longer. Long later was charged with fraud, literally a criminal charge fraud, at the freshwater fishing tournament, which is a third degree felony in Texas. He was arrested on Friday before being bailed out, $25,000. Long, who could not be reached for a comment Thursday, was disqualified from the tournament for altering a bass. Yeah, there's apparently there's a lot of cheating going on in the bass tournaments. Who knew?
I'm just surprised. 25 grand to bail out? Seriously?
I know.
Over a fish.
Yeah, yeah. The cops hooked a big one.
Oh,
yeah.
Lord.
For you folks wanting to cheat at these bass tournaments, be wary. You know, we have the fish police out there looking for you. And I think that's perfect time for inspirational close, because we need something to help us.
This week's inspirational close is a story titled The Group of Frogs, and it's an encouragement story, which I think all of us, this is a rare time in life that we're all, everybody, and I'm talking around the globe, is kind of affected by
we're all in this together.
Similar adversity, which is...
Yeah.
Is rare. So this story is about a group of frogs. As a group of frogs was traveling through the woods, two of them fell into a deep pit. When the other frog crowded around the pit and saw how deep it was, told the two frogs there was just no hope left for them. However, the two frogs decided to ignore what the others were saying, and they proceeded to try and jump out of the pit. Despite their efforts, the group of frogs at the top of the pit were still saying that they should just give up. They should never make it out. Eventually, one of the frogs took heed to what the others were saying, and he gave up, falling down to his death. The other frog continued to jump as hard as he could. Again, the crowd was still yelling at him, "Stop the pain and just die." He jumped even harder, and he finally made it out. When he got out, the other frog said, "Did you not hear us?" And the frog explained to them that he was deaf and thought that they were encouraging him the entire time.
Cheering him on.
This is a great perspective right now. You need, in some regards, to be deaf to what the outside world is saying and take personal responsibility. You can wash your hands. You can stay as clean as you can. Wear your mask. Wear your gloves. If you were a server and lost your job, how about look at it in the deaf sense that, you know what, I didn't really want to be a server the rest of my life, and now is an opportunity to become something else. Hope is a beautiful thing. Do not give up. No matter what hole you're in, no matter how deep it is, keep jumping as high as you can. And I promise you, and I know from experience, you'll get out of that hole. God bless everybody. And we will be back next week.
Batch Boys. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired Police Sergeant Darren Birch and retired Police Officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys, heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide Networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.